Hello, and welcome to today's show. My name is Andrea Isaacs, and the show is What We Need to Know. Today, I'm having my second interview with Dario Nardi. Dario is a neuroscience researcher at UCLA, and he has a brain lab. And when I first met Dario and heard that he did research, I was so excited. And I've had the just delightful opportunity to work with him in the recent past, and we had some exciting results, and we're going to continue our project, and we're going to tell you some of what we found in the lab. First I want to say welcome, Dario. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, absolutely, Andrea. I'm delighted, and we've had so many insights from our experiences together. I'm very excited to share those.
Yeah, and it excites me that you're excited about this, too. It just really thrills me. So for the listeners who are new to this work, I want to give you just a few definitions before I start asking Dario questions. So any emotion, for those of you who don't know the work, is based on the Enneagram. It's a personality system. Ennea meaning nine, it describes nine different patterns of thinking, feeling, and how we live in the world. And each personality style has different strengths and challenges. And any emotion is a way to use movement exploring different personality styles. And one of the benefits that comes from doing that is that we were able to capture mudras and mantras. Those are both Sanskrit terms. A common mantra is Om. A common mudra could be a prayer or meditation position. And I use some creative license, and I say any phrase can be a mantra. Captures what you want to feel more of. Any body position can be a mudra that supports the mantra of what you want more of. And together, my belief before meeting Dario, and continues to be my belief, and we're having scientific evidence of this fact, that when you use those mudras and mantras, you're actually changing the brain. And when we change the brain, it can actually change how we think, feel, and live. So if we're not living emotionally, or if we're not living the way we want in any way, there's hope. There is a way to change old habits. You know, many of us have found emotional change to be difficult. And it's because the neural pathways that come from the brain for our patterns and habits of things that we think, feel, and do a lot, those pathways are very strong. And that's a lot of why change is difficult. But when we use the body, we are changing the brain. We are creating new neural pathways that can really quiet the mind and can change how we live. So that's a little bit of background. One of the way that Dario researches the brain is with an EEG. And that means, and you can describe this more than I can, but my awareness is that we have these pads that are inside a cap that goes on top of a person's head. And with applying some gel to it, it increases the connectivity to the head, to the skull, which then can pick up the patterns, the waves, whatever you call them, in the brain.
The voltage changes, yes.
Changes, is that what you said?
The voltage changes, yes.
Pick up the voltage changes in the different regions in the brain because of the number of pads you have.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Dan, I know that you've done a lot of research in the lab, and you've had a lot of interest connecting your discoveries with personality systems. You've been working more with the Myers-Briggs system. It's probably part of why you've been interested in this project. Do you want to say a little bit about your background working with personality systems in the brain?
Sure. Yeah. It is going past a little bit of 7 years now, and using EEG in a sort of open-ended laboratory setting. A lot of it is exploratory type of research. I always say that it's an elaborate pilot study. We do follow a protocol, though, and this is actually the first time in working with you that I've modified that protocol in 6 some odd years in order to look at stuff that really is more multimodality. I've always did things that were visual and auditory and so on, but to add in an extra element of motion, of breathing, and then weaving all of that together, I think has been really, really interesting. So yeah, I've been looking at people of all different, people who identify with all different personality types. And, I am not a stickler for using any particular model because, of course, a model is a generalization about the world, and it's a tool, and it's a lens and a language, to help us get a handle on some ways that people behave and maybe what they think and feel. And just as a way to really understand the full range of the way that people think and respond to things. And as it's become clear, people have these pathways, and their favorite pathways can fire as often as once every second or even faster. So when we talk about reinforcement of the patterns in our lives, if we're firing these every second or more, our favorite ones, boy, you know, that's, we're really reinforcing everything we do with every breath. And so it's just been really fascinating to uncover not just which regions of the brain are more active or not in a particular 2 or 3 hour period, which is how long I tend to spend with folks, but what are those underlying neural circuits? And fortunately, the math now allows us to discover and reveal what that is.
You know, what you're saying is reminding me of how incredibly powerful our self-talk is. When someone's saying, oh, boy, that was really, that's going to be tough. That's going to be a challenge. Oh, that's going to be really tough. We're talking our brain into believing that something's going to be really tough, and it becomes really tough. If well, how curious. And just holding on to a positive result, it changes the brain. And as we move through maybe even the same set of sequences, the same sequence of events, there's a different experience because of the self-talk.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I can say, and I mean this in a very positive way, as somebody who was mainly raised Catholic, that the ritual aspect of it, the physical motions, the verbalization, the visualization, the environment, the smells, all of those things reinforce. And ritual actually is incredibly powerful. So if we can help people create their own rituals that help actualize their goals, what's satisfying for them, then really that can be tremendously powerful, because then we're helping to put in a whole new circuit into the brain, not just some random things here or there that might evoke it.
You know, that's something else very interesting to pursue. In a way, doing the mudras and mantras is a type of ritual. Something can be reinforced with every breath, as you were saying earlier. But the idea of something that's even more ritualistic could be really interesting to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And naturally, people have wondered, especially with the personality research, is the way our brains are wired inborn or not? And what I find, originally I worked with mostly with college students, so my database is about 60-some of college students, and I've added, now I have over 80 people, and been adding a lot more adults, so people who are over 30 in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s. And what I see is that career has a tremendous impact. And even hobbies, because hobbies are things people may not do every day, but they do certainly several times a week. They think about it. These things tremendously impact the brain, too.
So engaging in your hobby changes the brain in a positive way?
Oh, absolutely. Because I compared a bunch of males around age 40 who were everything from professional musician who plays every single day for paid performance to music professor to somebody who had merely music as a hobby, albeit a good musician. And it was a gradation. So the one who played every single day, it's built in there. The circuits were very powerful, were very strong. But the one who played music every day, or not every day, but as a hobby, he too showed these musical connections that were there. So I want people to know that it really is, you know, the last few years, neuroscientists have been saying, yes, the brain is very plastic. That's the word they use.
Plasticity.
Yeah, plasticity. And it really is. I'm not saying that it can happen overnight. But one thing I love is it seems in working with any emotion and somatic focusing is that you can really leverage, I would say, it's not like you just have strong or they're weak. There's this range in between. And it seems like these are techniques that can really leverage that space in between. So you can bring up secondary or tertiary patterns, which are there for the person, but maybe not as used as much as they could be. And to pull those up into awareness and allow the person to further strengthen those, even after just, you know, 50 minutes has been really exciting to see.
Yeah. So, gosh, I have like 3 questions at once I want to ask you. I have to separate them. Okay. So the fact that whether it's music that it creates a strong neural pathway or any emotion, a question behind that is, does it give the brain more balance, or what's the benefit of having that circuit be strong?
Oh, well, of course, that's a very good question. One of the goals of therapy, well, let's say I'll pick 3 goals of therapy. And by therapy, I mean in the broadest sense, it could be coaching, it could be psychotherapy, it could be physical therapy, whatever it is. One of those is acuity, and part of that is self-awareness, but it could also be physical acuity. It's more awareness of everything that's going on. Another one is flexibility, so that we have a range of responses, so that when something comes up that's a surprise or outside our comfort zone, or simply we could get a better outcome if we could respond a different way, confidently, then the flexibility is there, allowing us to shift and to do something a little bit different.
I love that idea of flexibility. I think that's part of emotional intelligence, is to have emotional flexibility. Instead of saying, you know, whenever you do this, I do that. That's just who I am. That's not flexibility.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just for those listeners who are wondering what that third outcome is, or the possibility of new kinds of outcomes. So when we have more flexibility and when we have more acuity, we may realize that some of the self-talk we've had, as you've mentioned, some of the behavior patterns and whatnot that lead seemingly inevitably to certain outcomes, or even to visualize, oh, this is the only way it can end up, that we discover new kinds of outcomes.
You know, what you're saying is really exciting to me, because you're just describing how we can growth, personal growth, how we can change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, often people say, well, you know, it's been really hard changing this part of, you know, my life or whatever. And what you're just saying is that if we engage in these, whether it's any emotion or a favorite hobby or meditation, engaging in activities like this that give you the acuity, the flexibility, and the possibility of new outcome, I think those are so key into being able to live the life we want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So let's go back to the Brain Lab, and let's give the listeners who didn't hear our last call a bit of a sense of how you find the baseline, because that's where we started.
Okay, absolutely.
Maybe just a bit shorter than we did last time, a little capsule.
Yeah. In the lab, over the course of 3 days, we hooked up 4 volunteer folks, bless their hearts, to monitor their brain activity, as I did about an hour of my usual protocol, and then you led them through your any emotion and somatic focusing exercises. And for a couple of the volunteers, we also followed up the next day to see if they could evoke the results on their own from the mudra and mantras that you had developed with them. As for developing or looking for the baseline, of course, it's really important to know where it is that the person's coming from. And in fact, on different days, a person may come in a slightly different space. My view is that a person has a number of favorite patterns or default spaces that they show. And that my role is to initially define the baseline is to evoke what those are. And to have a sense of, okay, if we're trying to demonstrate change is possible, then where are they normally, so that we can recognize the change. And for all of the volunteers, it was sort of funny, maybe it was an accident, I don't know, that if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs, it turns out that all of them had an intuiting preference, which meant that more connection to sensing, more connection to trusting their instincts, their gut responses, relying upon memory, being more in touch with their body, giving them information from second to second, and trusting that staying in the moment was the developmental space that we sort of ended up moving them all into. Mm-hmm. That was something that they had in common. Each of them also had some particular differences, but it was really finding those bases that they were comfortable at, and then seeing, well, where are the deficits? Mm-hmm. Where are they not moving to? In 2 hours, we haven't seen them move to space X. Let's try and move them there, providing that safe and comfortable for them.
Would you say that in looking at someone's EEG when you don't know them, that what you see on your computer can help you determine someone's type, whether it's Myers-Briggs or Enneagram?
Well, you know, that, of course, people would – that's a very common question, and people would be delighted to think that or perhaps not that their personality could be calculated in some way from their brain activity. I would say that the good news is that in the nature-nurture debate, that nature remains, even in the folks we saw in their 60s, it remains a potent force. And that a lot of things we can guess about the person from their personality, from the brain activity. That said, the nurture part, which is the other 50%, which could be any number of things, a career being major among them. But also, it seems like there's a natural growth process that happens. So in terms of just looking at the amount of brain activity, that's actually sort of dangerous with older folks. It's deceiving because it seems like once we get into midlife and later, we tend to use parts of our brain we didn't develop earlier in life, whether we want to go there or not. So we can't quite determine because sometimes a person looks like a mirror image of who they are.
Can you give me an example of someone doing that, developing a part of their brain in later in life that they never used earlier?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had one subject who came in, and he was a professional musician playing day to day, and he wasn't trained in any particular way. He had Myers-Briggs preferences for INFJ, which essentially, to take that apart, is intuiting and feeling and judging. So very creative, open-ended, also in touch with other people, strong imagination, attentive to people's facial expressions and their cues, wanting to please others, paying attention to group norms and so on. Also planful person. I mean, well-organized, planful. And when I just looked at the amount of brain activity, first of all, I would expect as somebody who's a professional musician and somebody who has good people skills that he would be paying attention to sound, to voice, that the regions of the brain in the temporal areas that support that those would be very active. And in fact, they weren't. The picture we got after 3 hours was somebody who was extremely sensory-oriented, logical. All the regions involved in imagination were essentially turned off, a terrible listener. And this didn't represent him at all. In fact, this was somebody who's about 40, whose brain activity was the complete opposite of what we would expect. And it wasn't because just of the lab environment. I mean, he was in fact doing music and engaging in social activities. The good news was, as we can dig deeper, we can look at the neural circuits that develop over many years. And unfortunately, you can't do that in real time. So that's something that we basically take the data after the session, we stick it into the computer and it does an analysis and spits that back after a few minutes. And what we saw was actually him as developed over 40 years. And it showed clearly that he had developed all these things about an imagination, social skills. But it had become like signing his name. That you know, just as any of us sit down to sign our name and don't think twice about it because it's so easy, that all of these skills around music, around listening and so on, the imagination were just built into him. So the story of who we are really is actually very complex. And I would say we cannot talk about personality unless we also talk about development.
Yes, that's right. Well, I want to get into some of the specifics of things that came up, and we're going to take a break in a little bit. But before the break, if you could define what the colors mean when we start to see the graphs on the computer responding to what's going on in the brain. I remember some of the yellow is integration and red is theta when there's more openness to learning. But if you could tell our listeners a little more than that about what the colors mean,
sure.
Then we can get into some of the more specifics about what happened.
Naturally, when people first come into my lab, either as a subject or as a confederate or like you as a colleague, they want to see the computer screen. They want to know, ooh, what's happening in the brain? And then they're assaulted with all of these colored bars and so on that you might think takes a PhD to decipher. but first of all, people do get used to it fairly quickly, and then they realize the process is sort of boring. Except for those really wonderful moments where something happens. There's the computer represents various wave bands. So maybe you've heard terms like alpha waves or beta waves or theta waves, something like that. So that's what the EEG is showing. And it represents those using color, at least the system that I use. It runs along a spectrum. So black is indicating essentially there's no activity, like you're asleep. And blue is awake and relaxed. As we move along the color spectrum, then from black to blue to green, green is often associated, these are called theta waves, with a problem-solving mode. And it tends to be a little bit more objective and detached. So it takes some information from the limbic system, but it doesn't become emotionally overwhelmed or something like that. Oftentimes people will show this not just when they're problem solving, but when, for example, they lose at a game of cards or something, because people don't want to feel the feeling of losing, but they do want to problem solve around it so they can win the next time. At least folks who are mentally healthy. There are some folks we've seen who have problems where they show this even around good things, and then they don't enjoy life. The next step up is yellow, and that's an associated state. So that's really the neocortex, that outer layer of the brain, is throwing open the doors and windows to the rest of the brain and the body and saying, hey, tell me all of your biases and your impulses and your strong memories and your phobias and your attachments, and I'm going to use all that information. And so it can feel really wonderful at times. And for a while in neuroscience, they thought alpha was this wonderful state for people to be in. Except, of course, if you're asked to recall some childhood trauma or something like that, then all of a sudden feeling all those things again isn't so pleasant. So it can be a very integrated state, but I call it an associated state. Mm-hmm. And then there's orange, which is much more like a physical action. But it could also be just when the person is contemplating action in the brain. It's been associated with dopamine. Listeners have probably heard about dopamine as related to either mental or physical movement. And that's what that is. And finally, there's red, which has been linked to blasted insights. I've also seen it's related to when they do speed dating and you see somebody really attractive, your brain is going to go to the state. And it's essentially this really high frequency, all hands on board. Hey, this is really important and exciting. Let's really pay attention to this.
Got it. Yeah.
And it's sort of like an emergency broadcast system. It's saying, hey, here's, or it, we call it an opportunity broadcast system. Uh-huh. We've seen these range of things. So it's not just the amount of activity. It really is the colors as well that reveal. And we noticed, as we'll get into later with our volunteers, that they showed very little alpha for the most part. And how then could we help them tap into more alpha?
Great. Okay, well, that's what we were looking at. We were looking at bars and all those different colors with different amounts of amplitude or strength. And we are going to find out more. We're going to let you know more about what happened in the Brain Lab after this break. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Andrea Isaacs. The show is What We Need to Know, and I've been talking with Dario Nardi about what happened when we brought any emotion and somatic focusing into the Brain Lab. So during the break, I was asking Dario if he would clarify one term for me, and then we're going to start telling you what happened in the lab. When we were in the lab, when we saw yellow, we got real excited because you were saying it's an integrative or an associated state, and I was asking him more about what yellow meant, and I want you to hear his answer to that. So take it away, Dario. What does yellow mean?
Okay, so what I do find with subjects is that they're going to preferentially show more of some wavelengths than others. So some person may be very blue and green. Another one may show a lot of red. That doesn't mean they show that all the time, but for the course of the session, or at least when they arrive, they're in a particular state. We noticed with all four of our subjects that they didn't show very much yellow, this alpha activity. And I wasn't really surprised by that. And if our goals are to increase sort of awareness and flexibility and so on, then the question is how can we help them experience more alpha? So what is alpha? Early on, folks thought in neuroscience that this was a state that was associated with pleasure and happiness, that there was a feeling of connectedness with the body and emotions, and was a pleasurable place to be when people are enjoying themselves. And absolutely that is the case, that when the neocortex, that outer layer of the brain, is really open to receiving and perhaps even being driven by what's going on in the limbic system below it, which is the sort of more primitive part of the brain, then they're going to show a lot of alpha. So the limbic system is home to things like memories that have a strong emotional content to them, bonds, biases, phobias, all of these things that probably in the Freudian handbook developed before age 2 or age 5, a little bit flippantly, but they're going to be there. And so when that person has the connectedness to it, sure, they're going to get that along with the different body sensations and so on that come up from the body through the limbic system. So it can be very pleasurable. But if we ask a person to go back and meditate, say, on a negative, childhood experience or traumatic moment in their lives, and they do naturally show a lot of alpha, it's almost as if they're going to be there again. And therapists know that people can store in their body in different places these these triggers for emotional trauma. And sometimes maybe we just are feeling badly. And so for whatever reason, even if we're in a bad mood, even if we're angry, whatever it is, you know, I know living in Los Angeles, somebody cuts us off in traffic and maybe we're going to have a limbic response. We're going to feel threatened.
So we were excited to see yellow in the scans because?
We were excited, I would say, for two reasons. One is that that was something that they weren't showing normally. So this indicated... And not only they weren't showing normally, but this indicated a place where they could go to perhaps to get more positive experience in their life. The second was this, that your process, what we were using with any emotion, somatic focusing, think about the word somatic, emotion, that those are indicating connection with the body, connection with sensation, and so on. And so we're really hoping to see that this multimodal approach that includes the body and sensation is actually going to evoke alpha. Because I have to be honest, if you're using techniques that are supposed to be tapping the body and breathing and motion and so on, and they're not getting us into alpha, that means that the subject isn't really experiencing it. They're going to say, oh yeah, I feel it, but I can tell you looking at the brain imaging that they're not. And then the good news was they did, that these processes did evoke alpha.
Yeah.
And so that's, it really said, yes, there's motion in the any emotion and there's somatic in the somatic focusing. And those are tapping there. That also reminds us when we're talking about the saying that alpha can be good or it can be bad, that's why it's important to have a coach, have a therapist, somebody who is practicing these techniques. So when you take a person to alpha, that you take them mindfully, that boundaries aren't crossed, that they don't suddenly, you know, recall some terrible childhood experience and become overwhelmed by that, that it needs to be done in the usual sort of the way that has expertise and thoughtfulness and empathy and so on.
Yeah. So let's start talking about what happened with some of our subjects. So I just want our listeners and our subjects to know we've changed the names to protect the innocence, so to speak. And so we worked first with, I'll call her Linda. So she had a couple of issues we were working on in the somatic focusing part. And part of it was she often felt overwhelmed by her emotions, and that I'm sure lit up certain parts of her brain. And she had a challenge, a great difficulty in moving into action. And I'm sure you saw that in the brain, and you could just define what you saw a little more in a moment. And then at the end, we went through a somatic focusing process, which is transforming a bad feeling into a good feeling. And then her mantras at the end of the somatic focusing, there were two. My emotions are my strength, and I move into action now. And they're both accompanied by a physical action, a mudra. My emotions are my strength, and I move into action now. So, Dario, could you talk a little bit about what you saw in the brain when she was in the midst of the emotional reactivity and overwhelm and frustrated about not moving into action, and then what you saw in the brain when she was saying those mantras, especially with the repeat of the mantra, and something that's coming up to me right now, I'm throwing a lot at you, I know, was whenever I would say, feel that in your body, feel that in every cell of your body, then there was a greater shift. So if you could describe that journey from the brain's perspective, that would be really great.
Certainly. So you've laid out the path that she went through. And what I saw in the brain activity starting off was a tremendous amount of what she came in as her baseline, which she was fairly relaxed, but also a little bit hesitant on the first day and a little bit in a problem-solving mode. I mean, I think that this was even her first time with you in person, wasn't
right.
it? Even though she knew you from the shows and webinars. And of course, she hadn't met me, and she had kindly flown in from somewhere else.
Yes.
So there was a lot of new stuff going on, and this is very natural, I see, at the beginning, that people just want to get comfortable. Now, as she went through the process with you, I would not say that it was very linear. It was more like there were these little hints now and then of going to alpha, but not wanting to go to a place that could be uncomfortable. So she could cognitively say, oh, I often, you know, feel overwhelmed by emotions if, but she's saying that from a distance. Or she's, you know, I tend not to go into action. And meanwhile, she's sitting there talking about not going into action, but she's not going into action. So these were really said from a distance. And part of what you were doing was in evoking this alpha state was to get her in touch with those feelings. And a natural consequence we saw with that is towards the end, that she was starting, you know, to be moved emotionally, that she would talk about being moved to tears. Well, she was moved to tears. And in terms of the motion aspect, we did get up, of course, and do motion activities. And it was really the next day that when we hooked her up again that we saw she arrived in a completely different state that was much more action-oriented. And overall, one of the lessons or a couple of the lessons we got from this is that over the session that it emerged very slowly and that main shift was only in the last few minutes, and that in fact she really needed that support, 5 or 10 minutes away from the end when really she was starting to go to alpha seriously. She needed your support there to sit next to her to talk her through it and so on. And so that was a really big piece, and that was exciting. The other that you mentioned is that absolutely when people do these exercises, even if you stand them up and get them moving, they don't necessarily connect with their body, especially if their tendency is to sort of, I would say, lead with their head to begin with. And what then needs to happen is what you did, and we saw it time and again, where you keep needing to ask the person to reconnect, to feel every cell, to remind them that they have a body and have appendages, and to feel those. And it was so predictable because when you, it was sort of like their brain activity wants to snap back to their safe zone.
Yeah.
And whether that was as they get too close to something emotional, and we would see that, they might step back then very quickly. And we saw that with a different subject, that we got to this point where really it's all this alpha activity and connecting with his body, and then all of a sudden he's like, no, I don't feel safe. I don't want to go there.
Yes.
Yeah, if you could even just, he said, you know, physically stand further away, and because that's part of that safety issue. And so he said, let me keep going on my own, even though I'm going to go at a slower pace. It's a pace that needs to happen. So I would say it's the shift happens, that we learned that the prep exercises are very important so the person feels comfortable, sort of like warming and stretching before doing gym exercise, that people will they, especially if they don't naturally show a lot of alpha, that they need to be continuously reminded to go back into their body to be anchored there.
Yes. And speaking of which, I want to give our listeners a little take home here, because though our the subject, Linda, in this case, used had the mantra, she had a physical experience, and so she was engaging her body. If our listeners use the mantra that she came up with, my emotions are my strength, if you find that that's a challenge for you, I invite you to use that. But don't just say it with your mind. Feel it in your body. And what we saw in the lab is whenever I said, feel that in your body, feel that in every cell of your body, every time I said it, they went more and more deeply into alpha. And then the other mantra that she had was, I move smoothly into action now. And if you feel that energetically, I move smoothly into action now. You know, if you feel that in your body, if that's been a challenge for you, I invite you to use that in your life as well, because the more you feel it in the body, the more it will change the brain, and the more it will change how you live, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And really what you've tapped into is this talking about these neural circuits that are there, is this idea of integration within the brain, that if we have particular needs, like moving smoothly into action. Okay, so one of the issues that she needs, simply stronger neural circuits that connect thought regions, planning regions, into the part that are actually executing the actions. And those neural circuits are not going to build all by themselves. So yeah, it's fine to mentally rehearse those, to visualize that, to move. And the research shows that even visualization can help. Adding actual physical movement, and in fact, whether it's actual physical movement or just visualization, needing to feel it. Because we really saw towards the end, when you really hand over the process to them,
yes,
in the last few minutes, and you sort of, when their voices go lower and then lower, and they say it only to themselves internally, we'd actually see this huge blossoming of alpha then, when they're really able to connect it with their body. And that's why I say it really was like all 50 minutes is needed. in order to get them to this place where they can do it on their own internally. And to feel that is really important.
Dario, I loved what you just said, and that what you said is based on what you saw in the brain. Because it's funny how that particular exercise was created, because I talk to people so much about exaggerating what's happening in the body and doing it bigger or doing it more, really exaggerating. And then it came to me one day, well, why not do the opposite? Why, I call it DZAG. Why not? Instead of saying it out loud and with the body, you know, how do you use that in life? If you're in an office in a meeting and you need more confidence, how do you, you know, stand up in that position and say, I hold my ground and speak my voice? You know, you can't interrupt a meeting and do that. And I thought, well, this is useful. How can we do that? And so it came to me that we could say it more quietly and do the movement smaller. We could say it more quietly and do the movement smaller. We could say the words quietly in our mind only and not do any movement. And by then, the neural pathway is there. The brain knows the difference between imagination and reality. So it's taking you to that place more even more deeply. And I'm just, I about jumped out of my skin when you saw that validated in the brain scan.
Yeah, and absolutely, it's not even just me. It's in our short experience together. The research out there really suggests that when people do visualization properly, that has tremendous learning potential and can change the brain, exactly as you said. It really can help. It was sort of like in sports, the visualizing of a high-performance action. And as long as they're feeling that as well as visualizing it,
yeah,
then that can be really cool. And this is where I just wanted to say, this is – sometimes people ask me, well, now that, you know, you've seen so much over 7 years, Dario, with the brain, like, why do you need these personality models? And I think this is a great example. So let's talk about, just very briefly, my experience a few months ago when you led me through and some other people through experiencing one of the Enya types. Mm-hmm. And it was a type I wasn't really familiar with, and I was excited to experience it. And the mudras and mantras that we practiced were not necessarily intuitive. Like it was sort of like, oh, I didn't realize that's how that type works. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it was a type 8, Enya type 8. And it's not necessarily about aggression or being angry. There's a strong element of rootedness that's there. And to really feel that in the body and feel that in the legs and in the back and in the feet, like that is actually what provides the confidence and the stature, I would say, the stature that goes with Enya type 8. And so that's the value of the personality models, is people have been thinking about these things and observing people and interviewing them and so on for years and years and years. And they provide us with so many clues then about how to create mudras and mantras, how to do the motions and the visualization and the words and what words to use. It gives us really great starting points that might be counterintuitive, and just by the brain activity itself, we're not going to know what those are. So I would say that's really, you know, and continue to be very helpful for me. And I would say that's the benefit of good personality models. And I'm an advocate of any personality model as long as it brings some satisfying results and is reasonably close to reality.
Yes. Yeah. So could you going back to your personal experience, Dario? What was a take-home for you that was you found most useful in your life?
Well, the take-home is that these are things that I find myself practicing. Oh. And I think the way I've said it is very important, because at first I sort of thought, well, you know, gosh, I'm going to have Andrea, she probably can practice, you know, all 9 of them every day, all the time. And isn't her brain so busy doing that all the time? But of course, you know, I've been working with personality for 20 years, and I've been certified, and people ask, well, you go around analyzing people all the time? And I'm like, no, not really.
Yeah, right.
A lot of it is just completely automatic. It's like I meet the person and I know. And I just, it's not even something to really think about. I just adjust my language and so on, assuming I feel like doing that, and that's appropriate. And it really is the same thing. And so I found myself, not with the full range of things that we did, but with a number of things, practicing those. And just going back to being, so all of a sudden it pops up into my mind, oh, why don't you do this? Oh, why don't you do this? Every so often, and then more often.
And that this is which mantra?
In this case, it actually wasn't a mantra that I focused on personally, although there is one that occasionally comes up with that too. It's just that notion of being rootedness, and it reminded me of when I started doing gym works out some 15 years ago, and the importance of good posture. And I remember sitting in the seat of, you know, sort of the gym machine, and the trainer, they're saying, you know, you really want your feet rooted into the ground when you do these, that you're applying pressure from your feet, even when you're lifting something with your arms. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, so that your whole body is aligned and connected when you're doing that. And it connected so well with what we talked about in practice with any type A that it's just gotten me back into that mode and reminding me to plant my feet and to feel rooted. Of course, even when I'm moving, there's a feeling of connectedness there. And to me, that goes back to this research on habit building in the brain, that, you know, how long does it take to build a new habit? And that could be in terms of emotional responsiveness, behaviors, whatever it is. And in fact, we see this is all connected in the brain. The brain doesn't have like just an emotional part, just a reasoning part. There are regions that help more with one or the other, but they're all integrated. And to see that habit building is integrated.
I want to talk more about the habit building in the brain. And it's time for us to take another break. So when we come back, we'll talk a little more about how people can change those habits. And maybe we'll give you another example of what we learned in the lab. And we'll be right back to do that. So stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Andrea Isaacs. The show is What We Need to Know. And I've been talking with Dario Nardi. He's a neuroscience researcher. He's also the author of several books, fiction and nonfiction. Two of his nonfiction titles that are relevant to our discussion include The Neuroscience of Personality and 8 Keys to Self-Leadership. And his website is darionardi.com. That's DarioNardi.com for more information on him. Before the break, we were talking, Dario mentioned building new habits, habit building, on how people create new habits. And I know I'm often asked this question, how long does it take to make change? And there's a lot of research out there that says it takes, you've got to do it like 27 times or 3 months, or I've heard so many different answers. And my response usually is, when the motivation for change is there, and when you've created a new alternative response to the old habit that you don't like, when you've created the new response, which means creating a new neural pathway, the change really can be immediate because you have the alternative literally in the palm of your hands. And so that's been how I responded to that question. And you started talking about habit building before the break. So I'd like you to describe how people do that in your experience with the brain, using what you know about the brain.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I want to really support what you just said, that motivation is critical, that it's very easy to talk about the brain and competencies, that we have skill for this or that, or it helps us with some task. But motivation is a big part of it too. And we may have a region of the brain that's very well wired for something. For example, programming and mathematics are two regions I must do well in. But do I have motivation for those? And so that really is a big piece. And then the other is something that's, I think, been known for a while, that with those really ingrained pathways that are there for responsiveness, it's not possible to simply, at least at this time, to go in and erase them. Maybe there'll be some technology in the future. I don't know. So what can we do? The idea is then to give the brain alternatives and to build up alternative pathways, exactly as you said. So how do we build those alternative pathways? Well, one is to identify which, and that's the acuity and awareness part, which pathways need to be built, and to help the person then develop some exercises that they can practice in order to strengthen, say, between region A and region B, or whatever, maybe it's a particular whole brain mode that they can go to as well. And to simply identify those. And then the other is to create something that is that exercise that helps build it. And the more multisensory it is, the more it's going to engage the brain as a whole into the task. Especially when it involves something physical and emotional that will bring in the limbic system, which is the ultimate decider of what is motivating for us. So those are – now, how long does it take? And absolutely, there's a wide range of research. In terms of folks who do neurotherapy, they say if a person comes in – I don't do neurotherapy, but I'm talking with people who do. And they say, well, you know, I have a problem with memory or with clumsiness or something like that. And they're like, okay, let's work with that. Mm-hmm. And the person will come in, say, 3 days a week for a half-hour session, or 5 days a week, but let's say three. And then they do that for 10 weeks. So over the course of 30 sessions, they will have gone through these brain training processes. And the brain training is not just sitting there playing a game. Like, it actually involves a EEG or similar kind of equipment to monitor the brain, to give feedback and so on, to know that the change is happening. So that 10 weeks is really sort of that 3 months that is frequently talked about. I do believe that it can go faster. If a person has a neural circuit that's there and is modestly developed, not super, but modestly developed, just by redirecting the person's attention and the things that stimulate the brain, you can change very quickly as they just shift from using one circuit to a different one.
So I'd like to add something onto that and then hear your response to that. So with my clients, they'll come up with, they bring me a presenting issue that they want to change in their lives, and we conclude the session with a mudra and a mantra. And they instead of seeing me for half an hour, 3 times a week, or 5 days a week, or for 30 days, whatever, they have a take home that they can do a million times a day. Because the more you say that in your mind, and once you have the neural pathway, it's activated even just by thinking it quietly in your mind. They're doing essentially what you would do, have someone do when they come back and they see the neurotherapist for 30 minutes, however many times. Mm-hmm. They can expedite, they can fast track that emotional transformation, that change, by practicing, I call them M&Ms, the mudras and mantras. By practicing their M&Ms over and over and over and over and over again, they are strengthening that neural pathway, and I believe that that expedites the change they want to see in their lives.
Absolutely, and that's the value of giving homework assignments to people, as not only is that element of practice that happens there, But it's helping the person integrate those changes into their environment. So we call this an ecological approach, whatever their ecology is, their home environment, their work environment. And this is often seen. You know, the person can then see some shifts in say, the clinician's office. And then they go home back to their old environment and relationships and stimuli and so on. And they immediately pop back to these previous behaviors. So it's really important to practice and to have those exercises available to them in their regular environments.
Yeah. Yay. Well, Dario, we just have a couple minutes left. What do you have any words in summary that you'd like to have our listeners hear?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the cool things we saw is there were a couple of people who came in who had already been practicing meditation for a while or some other kind of technique. And we found that they really could get their brain into a particular state quite quickly. And this was exciting to see. So this really was a reminder that having a daily practice or regular practice is tremendously valuable. Now, overall, the lessons that we learned, one is you got to make it multisensory, multimodal. So the person is moving, they're active, there's a verbal part, a physical part, and so on. The other one is that warm-up is important. Just doing something for a few seconds is okay, but sometimes, and especially for those of you listening who are coaches or therapists or whatnot, to know that you need your whole session, all 50 minutes or whatever it is, and that sometimes the big results happen only in those last few minutes, that it's very slowly leads up to it. And the other is for people who have a difficulty being associated, being in their body, the constant reminders for them, urges to feel their limbs, to feel through their cells and their body and so on, can be tremendously helpful. At the same time, you may also want to sometimes briefly be ready to step back and give the person space to try it on their own. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, as you mentioned, with the homework assignments, so they have something that they can take home and do on their own is really, really valuable.
Yeah. Well, I have this a phrase that I really like. Listen, it really is anchored into your answer to the question, what do you want? What would your body prefer? And I like to say, listen to your body and change your brain. Easy tools for lasting change. And really the answer lies in, what does the body want? And so if you find yourselves caught in this emotional reaction that you're not wanting to experience, change the energy in your body to something you prefer and just see what happens. So thank you all for listening. Dario, thank you so much for your time today. I just love engaging this conversation and this exploration with you, and I'm excited to continue it.
Oh, absolutely. I am as well. And thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So thank you all again for listening, and we'll be back next week. Bye for now.